And welcome to episode 19 of Artist Materialist. I'm Susanna, an artist and graphic designer.
I'm Dan, a material scientist.
And today we are talking about an article from The Atlantic called How to Write a Book Without Losing Your Mind, subtitled Expert Advice on Ending Procrastination and Finishing That Manuscript, Dissertation, or Other Big Project by Olga Kazan. And it is an article about procrastination and how to overcome it. And this is a topic that it's really easy to go down the rabbit hole on. There's so much out there about procrastination. And Dan, you were just telling me about an expert on procrastination that have you read his book?
I read he spent some like 6 or 7 years taking every psychological study that he could and coding it in terms of interpreting for procrastination. So a giant meta-analysis, more than 100 articles, might have been more than 400 articles. And he wrapped it all up, and using that and the theory of hyperbolic discounting, which is a psychological behavioral economics theory that was developed by George Ainslie, he then put together this idea that you could sum up procrastination as an equation. And so the name of this professor is Piers Steele, and his website is procrastinus.com.
That's great.
And his equation is that motivation equals expectancy of success times the value that you place on success divided by your personal impulsiveness and how much time you have.
That is a pretty good equation. And it touches on something that all the stuff that I've read on procrastination doesn't or didn't talk about, which is the motivation. Because in the original article, the one we started with, it assumes the motivation. It's talking about, for the author, a book that she's been paid to write. So she has a lot of obvious motivation, or a dissertation or something that you know is important and you know you need to finish by a certain deadline or at all. And I understand procrastinating in that sense. But some of the other things I read, there was NPR replayed some interviews they did yesterday in their On Point show about procrastination. So that was very timely. So they were talking about instant gratification. But one thing that they didn't address was, again, the motivation, because sometimes it's hard to decide if something is even worth doing.
Yes, specifically, and what this the motivation that equation goes to is, it's a comparative motivation. So what is your motivation to do one thing versus another thing? And the underlying thought about that in the world in terms of procrastination is that all of the procrastinating activities tend to be things that have a very constant motivation. So they tend to have things that you can do instantly and have a very consistent rate of success. So you know that you can scroll through Twitter. That's something you can do instantly. The chances of there being more tweets to read is very high. Maybe the value isn't very high, but it's, you know, you may not place much value on Twitter, but it's a very constant value. And so the motivation for Twitter is constant, whereas some big deadline, if it's far away, the motivation may be less until you get closer to the deadline. And at some magic point, it gets close enough so that the denominator gets smaller, and then it becomes more motivation to do the other thing.
And it certainly doesn't help that software developers have added those little alert icons so that you know you have 7 unchecked Twitter notifications and 12 unchecked Facebook notifications, and you get a sense of accomplishment for getting rid of that little red bubble with the number in it, even though you haven't really accomplished anything.
Yeah, and certainly from psychology, it'll say, the idea of inconsistent feedback in that sense of the gamification and the little notifications, that's the strongest way to develop a habit. So apart from the motivation, then there's also just the habit forming qualities.
Yes. And that was something that one of the people being interviewed on NPR talked about was beating procrastination is about forming habits that help you do that. And I can't remember which one of the people they talked to, Andrew Santella, who wrote a book called Soon about procrastination, and Tim Urban, who gave a well-known TED talk about procrastination. But they did talk about how forming habits can help you overcome the tendency to want to procrastinate. And actually, some of the advice that Laura Vanderkam, that's who Olga Kazan talked to in this article in the Atlantic. She talked to Laura Vanderkam, who's a well-known productivity writer, about tips for getting rid of procrastination. And what she told her was to break everything down into smaller pieces, because then you can really get some of that instant gratification if you complete a small piece.
The breaking into small pieces, I mean, it's a classic, it's one of the classic pieces of advice for starting a big project. And yet I've seen for myself that sometimes it can be such a, if it's a particularly large project, like how can I break this into a smaller piece? And then you can end up spending all your time figuring out how to slice things and I'll write another outline. And that's another way to avoid ever getting started.
Yes, that is definitely a procrastination hole that I've fallen into, where it's a big project, and so you say, okay, well, I have to organize it. So you spend all this time organizing and researching and finding the right tools to do it, and you never get started.
And so with that, you see a lot of these articles about procrastination that are from the perspective of writers, because that's who writes these articles, is people who write. And in the one we're talking about today, one of the other pieces of advice is the write fast, edit slow. And I remember this from the only useful piece of productivity training I've ever received when I was working in the private sector. Was that the way to get to writing is to put your hands on the keyboard and keep them there.
That is excellent advice.
And yet, one of the things that presupposes, going back to the equation, is this sort of expectancy of success. So if the idea is that you need to write something, and that's what you need is a document that has a certain number of words, then if you write a certain number of words, then you've kind of succeeded. You may have done a poor job, but you've kind of succeeded. Whereas if you're trying to solve some sort of problem, then just writing gibberish or writing stream of consciousness, you might get some ideas out there, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you've actually made any progress.
And I think that's where breaking it down into small pieces does help. One of the most useful pieces of advice that I got out of therapy last year was something I heard, actually, I think it was on the first day or maybe the second day, and that was break everything down into small, manageable pieces. And the therapist wasn't specifically talking about writing, she was talking about everything in life at that point, because so many people who were in this group session were overwhelmed by everything in their life. So she was talking about anything you have to do, break it down into small pieces. And when I talked to her about that, she said, no smaller, no smaller. So sometimes it is just putting your hands on the keyboard or picking up the phone to call someone, which is hard for me. Sometimes it's just, okay, the first thing I'm going to do is pick up the phone. The next task is to find the person's number. Task number three is to call that number. And if I have to break it down that small to make myself do it,
yeah,
then that's what I have to do.
And I think, and part of that goes with, so there's sort of the motivation to start something, which is the equation part. And then the other part is sort of the task switching aspect. So these small pieces, a lot of it seems to, and I think, I don't know if Tim Urban goes into it so much in his talk, but the once you've started on a path, started doing something, you're more likely to keep doing it, as opposed to if you think about doing something, then, which is all of the academic jokes about procrastination are things, you know, the, you know, this weekend I will try not to feel guilty about feeling guilty about doing anything other than thinking about writing.
Yes. it's basic physics, right? An object in motion tends to stay in motion. Once you get started, you can stay on the path. It's a piece of advice that I don't know where it came from, but I think about it a lot, which is begin as you mean to go on. And sometimes I think about that when I'm starting to procrastinate. Okay, is this how I mean to go on, playing Candy Crush? No, it's not how I want to go on anyway. So let's begin, even if it's something that is, again, a very small step, it's in the right direction.
So one of the things that this article talks about, it goes through examples of researching all of the pens to find the most appropriate pen and different things like that. And it very much goes with this idea of reading about productivity as a form of procrastination, you know, productivity hacks as a way to avoid productivity. And that it's a really sensitive balance in terms of applying versus learning. And that's a big part certainly as somebody who reads a lot about this topic, I feel that deeply.
Yes, when they talk about perfectionism, how the writer in this case really wants the first draft to be perfect. And so she's afraid to start because she's afraid it won't be good enough. I feel that strongly. I have so many projects that I've gone and before starting it, I've been like, well, I can't really start it because I don't have the right kind of paints. So I can't even start sketching. Or, I mean, I have a book of sketches that I want to turn into paintings, and I didn't have the right brushes. Well, now I have the right brushes. I have the paints, but I don't know if I have the right canvas. Okay, I have the canvas, but I don't have the exact right place to do the work. So I have to clean off my entire desk so that I can start. And what I really need to do is just say, I'm never going to find the perfect place. I just need to stick the canvas on the kitchen table and start painting.
And I think there's a, that's one of the, so on the Procrastinus website, they talk about various different theories and they go against several of them. And I think what you might say is that it's not really about perfectionism as it is about, about an artificially inflated difficulty. So it's sort of like if the bar to clear is perfection, then you never expect to be able to succeed. And so you don't ever want to start it because it's just never going to be successful. And so it's a different form of breaking down into little pieces. If the bar to clear is, I'm going to put some paint on a canvas, like that's not necessarily so hard to do. And then it's much easier to say, I can do this.
And I wonder how much of our overinflated sense of expectations is due to seeing what others have done. You said made me think of a friend of mine from middle school who is a writer for an architecture magazine. She posted on Facebook a while ago that she is always telling her husband that if she had a better desk, she could be so much more productive. Her desk is just too small to write effectively. And then they went on a tour of a famous writer's house. And I wish I could remember. It wasn't Louise. It might have been Louisa May Alcott. I don't think it was. But it was a very famous writer who was very prolific. And they saw the desk at which she wrote all of her writing. And it was this little teeny tiny old-fashioned desk. And she said, after seeing that this famous writer wrote everything at this desk even smaller than mine, I feel like I don't have an excuse anymore.
Which is, I mean, which is not to say that these things don't matter. I mean, certainly having a comfortable workspace is definitely helps, because if you are constantly distracted because your back hurts, then you're not going to get any work done.
Right. And it does, it did mention in the NPR interviews, I think that was Santella, the author of Soon, said that people who procrastinate are also people who tend to be surrounded by clutter more. And I can attest to the fact that clutter does make me more distracted. It makes it harder for me to get things done because there are so many things around me drawing my attention. And I do live in a very cluttered house. It is very hard to get rid of clutter. I feel like it's constantly coming back in whenever I try to get rid of it. And clutter can certainly contribute to procrastination. But decluttering can also be a procrastinating technique.
Yes, definitely one of those 80-20 situations where you do the 20% of the effort that gets rid of the 80% of the clutter, or at least wrangle it into a sort of a steady state. And anything beyond that, you just know that it's just going to go back.
Yes. And I think this is a good time to bring up something that I kept coming across called the Eisenhower Matrix. Have you heard of that?
Yes.
And it's supposedly a way to help prioritize tasks that President Eisenhower, who was very productive and accomplished a lot, something that he used, where you clarify tasks as urgent, not urgent, important, and not important. And it's, there are these quadrants, and you put things in the different quadrants, whether it's important and urgent, and those are the things you do first, and not important and not urgent, and those are tasks you can just forget about. And that is a good way to declutter, I think, if you look at the clutter and say, okay, what is the most urgent stuff to get out of my way? But when I read about this matrix and thought about the tasks that I have to do, the things that do tend to make me procrastinate, I had a hard time deciding what was urgent. I mean, there are a lot of things that are urgent. Paying the bills, that's a very obviously urgent thing and important. But I have all these projects that are important. I don't know how urgent they are, and how important are they relative to each other? Well, yeah. Is working on this book more important than doing this illustration? You know, they're both maybe equally important. I don't know. And then I'll sit there and I can't decide which is more important, so I do neither.
So I first heard of the Eisenhower Matrix in the context of when people were starting to talk about email taking over their lives in a business setting, and how email is, or a phone call is definitely sort of the definition of urgent, because it demands immediate attention. Whether or not it's important, it's urgent. It's, here's a phone call. And email can be this similar, especially if somebody expects a quick response. That's, you know, here's the email, respond right now. And whether or not it's important. And so a big part of that is, of dealing with email, is shifting expectations of the people that respond, and setting in your own mind, okay, if it's an important email, I'll reply back. But otherwise, everyone else can just wait till I get to that time, because it might be somewhat urgent, or it may, you know, it can wait. And with that is the idea is that if you respond to everything that's urgent, that it demands your immediate attention, then you never get to the things that are important. And so I think as far as like the working on one project versus another project, I think this gets in a little bit to something that, again, Professor Steele is not a fan of, but I've seen, I think this shows up in the TED Talk or the NPR discussions about how procrastination can be productive.
Yes, that was Andrew Santella.
Okay. And the so Jorge Cham, who does the Piled Higher and Deeper comics, he is very much into this productive procrastination. And I think it doesn't work for everyone, but it definitely worked for him. It turned into his career. And I think the key there is if you have a couple of different important projects, you can use one to effectively be procrastinating on the other, and then you're productive.
That is actually great advice. I like that.
It's like, oh, I don't know quite how to continue on this story. I'll procrastinate by doing the illustration.
That is really good. I will have to remember that one, because when I have multiple concurrent projects, which I think a lot of people who, you know, work in design and stuff like that have, I mean, you rarely just have one big project.
Mm-hmm.
And time management is always a struggle, where you decide, you know, which one do I need to get done when they both have the same deadlines.
Right. And it, you know, it gets to a certain point where there's something that really is urgent, and it's like, oh, I have to focus on this one, because if I don't focus on this one, I'm not going to get done on time. But the rest of the time, it's sort of, you know, just if the alternative is to be spinning your wheels, not doing anything, it's better to just do whatever first pops up. You know, oh, this is the one that's in front of me, I'll start doing that one. And even if it's not the most important or the most urgent, you'll still make progress on it. And that's good.
I'm envisioning a sort of wheel of fortune with all the different projects on it. Spin it. Okay, what am I doing this morning? Not a bad idea. One thing that all the procrastination advice didn't quite touch on, I felt, was a fear of failure. And mm-hmm. I mean, it touched on it a little bit, but it didn't use the word fear. And I don't know if that's something that they didn't want to talk about openly or just didn't acknowledge that that's what it was. But I think in a lot of cases, procrastination is about fear. It's fear of not doing well, or it's fear of having to do something difficult, fear of being uncomfortable, fear of confronting something you don't want to confront. I know that there are certainly things that I have not dealt with because of fear, and for all those reasons. I mean, even if it's just, you know, fear of getting bitten by mosquitoes and really sweaty and dirty because I don't want to work in the garden, and so I'll do anything else to avoid going out there.
Well, I think that's what you just said is the looking at the website, and they talk about different theories of procrastination, and they sort of say, you know, about anxiety and fear and fear of failure, that those are reasons to avoid doing something entirely. It's not necessarily that, oh, I'll do it tomorrow. It's like, I just don't want to do it at all.
That's a good point. The difference between telling yourself that I'll do it tomorrow and telling yourself, I just plain don't want to do it.
Yeah.
And I procrastinate for both reasons. I don't want to do it right now, and I don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm washing the dishes instead of cleaning the cat box, I don't want to clean the cat box. And washing the dishes is something productive. And I am procrastinating, but it's not because, you know, I'll say I'll do it tomorrow. I just flat out don't want to do it ever, but I don't have to. And then there are the things that I think, as Tim Urban described, you put off to your future self, mm-hmm. where you say, oh, you know, future Susanna is going to be so ready to do this, and she'll be do a much better job at writing this letter than I will. And mm-hmm. she'll be so inspired that I shouldn't do it now. I'm too tired. It's too late in the day. Future Susanna tomorrow morning will
Yeah.
have a fresh mind, and when I wake up, it's still me, and I'm not in a better mood to write it.
So I don't know if you saw the, there's a New York Times article a year or two ago about procrastination that I think I posted on Twitter. And it was a report from the 10th annual workshop on procrastination.
I didn't know that they had procrastination workshops, let alone 10 of them. That's pretty impressive.
And the big thing that was being reported on, which I thought was really interesting, because these were researchers from around the world, so it wasn't just the United States. The thing that got reported on, I thought was really interesting, is looking at any group of people or any nation they could find, that the number of people who are chronic procrastinators was really about 20%. And
Yes,
irrespective.
they mentioned that in the article, the Atlantic article. I see that now.
Yeah, they meant, and it's sort of like, oh, about 20%, but really, that's not just like, oh, 20% of, weird Americans or something. That's really, if you go to Peru, it's going to be about 20%. You go to Sri Lanka, it's going to be about 20%.
That's really interesting. I wonder what it is about people's brains, like I could say our brains, because I know I am a chronic procrastinator, that makes us procrastinate more than other people. And I see that the guy who did this study, Joseph Ferrari, he did the study about clutter, and people's level of clutter predicted their tendency to procrastinate. And now I'm wondering what international clutter would look like. Would it look the same as my clutter? Which is a lot of books and paper, or would they have different kind of clutter? All the same, though, it is a little bit comforting to know that there are procrastinators around the world.
Yeah, and it makes me think about how, there's about at various times we might have cultural stereotypes about, there's certain countries that, are thought of as being more on time or more flexible about time, but that doesn't seem to make any difference as to how what percentage of people have this, what might be said is have a greater sensitivity to delay is the seems to be the real big individual variable.
So by sensitivity to delay, do you mean the people who feel like delay doesn't bother them versus the people who are very sensitive to it and really hate delays?
So the sensitivity to delay is how is it's this goes to this the hyperbolic discounting.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. Could you
Yes.
explain that, please?
So that hyperbolic discounting is just from the in terms of the procrastination equation, it's just how the how in the equation that time is in the denominator. It's not a multiplier or an exponent or a subtraction, it's a denominator. So basically the motivation goes towards infinity as the deadline approaches.
Okay, that makes
And
sense. That's what Tim Urban calls the panic monster,
yeah.
but in a slightly more scientific way.
So the sensitivity to delay is the thing, is the constant that you multiply the time by so that the math works out or so that it matches the curve. So if you have a very low sensitivity to delay, then that flattens everything out. And so you'll still, the motivation still goes up as the deadline approaches, but as you get further away from the deadline, it doesn't drop off as much. So everything kind of has a more flat motivation. And apparently, good news for all of us, one hopes, is that the sensitivity to delay tends to decrease with age.
Huh, I guess because we have left time, less time left.
Or because our time horizon has shifted such that, 5 days seems like a smaller fraction of our overall experience.
That's true. I mean, you tell a 9-year-old that something is going to happen in 2 weeks, and he feels like that's forever.
Yes.
Whereas I think, oh my gosh, 2 weeks, that's tomorrow.
And that's exactly what this time discounting is that you tell somebody that that I'll give you $10 now or $100 in 2 weeks, and if you have a really high discounting, you're like, I'll take the $10 now. I mean, there's other things that go into that as far as trust, how much you trust the person will actually give you the money and all of that. But just from a perspective of how much you discount the future, that's the sensitivity to delay.
There was this one guy who called in to the NPR show and said, I don't understand all these procrastinators. You people are just lazy. There's nothing good about procrastination. And I thought that was kind of funny because he's clearly somebody who has a very low sensitivity to delay. He just doesn't understand why anyone would procrastinate ever. And that's something I really can't understand. That maybe he's never done anything that he's worried about. I don't know. I guess if there are 20% of the population who are chronic procrastinators, maybe there's another 10 to 20% who are very punctual and never procrastinate.
And you can imagine one reason why that would be is if somebody who's really sort of anhedonic, who really doesn't take pleasure in anything, all of the things that they could procrastinate with, they just don't care. So they only do the things they have to do.
Yes, reminds me of the bodybuilder I read about, and I was reading his advice, and he talked about how it was really easy to just see food as fuel and just eat the healthy stuff because he never really enjoyed food. It was just something to strengthen his body. So if you have that sort of understanding of food, sure, it's easy to go on a diet because you don't care what you eat. But most of us aren't like that. Anhedonic, very good word to describe that.
And so, but one thing that that caller did have right is the sort of the definition of procrastination is an unproductive delay. It's something that, you don't want to do. No desire to be procrastinating. No, it's not something that you glory in or anything. It's a failure of self-regulation. And so, we always want to aspire not to do it.
Sometimes, though, what's procrastination is in the eye of the beholder. In the book Soon, the author looks at Charles Darwin and Leonardo da Vinci and looks at how the things that they were, in quotes, supposed to be getting done and the things that they wanted to do were a little bit different. So, but the thing is, they weren't being completely unproductive. They were doing things that were useful, maybe not as useful as what other people wanted them to do or what they should have been doing. But Leonardo da Vinci was working on interesting inventions, and Charles Darwin was investigating the properties of earthworms and barnacles. So it wasn't like they were just sitting there playing solitaire. They were actually doing something interesting to them, something that they thought was at least marginally important. It's just that other people didn't find it important when, for example, Leonardo had a commission to finish a particular painting or sculpture or something. Yes.
Right. Yeah, it's and that's the motivation is the value that we internally place on things, not the value that anyone else places on it. That
And
makes
where is
sense.
motivation again in Steele's equation?
That's what you're calculating for. That's the thing that comes out. So it's on the
That's
other side.
good. Yeah, because it really does all come down to motivation. In the Atlantic article, the author talks about being in the mood to write, but another word for that would be motivation. And of course, a deadline is great motivation. It's a matter of finding that internal motivation when you don't have a really hard deadline really close that's creating it for you.
One and so the, and when the deadline approaches, then it gives you a push, so it motivates you in the very literal sense.
I've heard as a technique for finishing large projects, you're supposed to give yourself intermittent deadlines. And that is a good way to do it. I know I've seen middle school teachers do that for the science projects, and I thought that was great.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
because I've and you have been in the situation where they say, okay, it's science project time, pick your topic, and it's due in 2 months. And
yeah.
then the night before you're like, oh crap, I didn't grow the mold spores or the plants, and I have 24 hours to do it.
Right.
So I've seen the teachers say, okay, pick your topic, and a week later your experiment plan is due, and a week after that this is due. And so that's good, but again, that is externally driven motivation. She's giving you these deadlines. So how do you do that internally? How do you set your own deadlines and stick to them? Because that's something I have had trouble with. I'll create my own deadline, say, okay, I have to finish this project, and my goal is by the middle of the week, I'm going to have this done. By the end of the week, I'm going to have that done. And I think the author here talks about it too, having the goals of, I'm going to write on Monday and Tuesday and edit Wednesday through Friday. But I found as a chronic procrastinator, it can be really easy to miss your own goals when you don't have anybody who's going to penalize you for it.
And I think this goes to, it goes back to this habit idea. And I think there's been sort of an elevation of internal motivation that maybe is sort of overdone, and that really the thing to do is build habits. And I think that's what, is good to do in school, is if the only way you've ever done a big project is, okay, if it's a big project, then I should do some this week and some next week and some next week. And that's the only way you've ever seen it done. Then if you have your own big project, then you might be inclined to do the same thing. Whereas if you grow up and the only way you've ever done a big project is you muse about it for 7 weeks and then do it in one night, then it can be hard to break out of that habit.
That's something we'll have to talk about in the future. See if we can find a good article about habits, because that is its own topic. And that is something that keeps coming up in other discussions that I've come across. Well, this has been a very interesting discussion of procrastination, and hopefully some of the things that I've learned from you and from reading these will help me procrastinate less.
Likewise. Thank you for joining us at Artist Materialist. You can find us at our new custom URL, artistmaterialist.com. Please rate, review, and share with a friend who you think needs to procrastinate less.